right, so I'm actually just starting my second year as a postdoc with Bridget and Clint. I do all the tomography, or most of the tomography. Bill Rice also does some of the tomography at NYSBC, and I do it using no fiducials. So I've never actually used any fiducials in my life, though Scott might say otherwise. We never actually use those fiducials at the AAV. So I do tomography on single particles, on fibsem lamella, reconstituted liposomes with various proteins, various filaments, actin, et cetera. And here I'm going to show you what I found with cryo-ET by studying single particle samples. So we're a big facility, as you've heard, and Bridget has mentioned that I've been doing tomography on a lot of single particle samples that have come through our facility over the past year. In fact, I've been doing it on over 50 different samples, collected over 1,000 tomograms. I'm going to show you some of those results today. And I think one of the people who actually realized that my tomograms might have some useful information, maybe inadvertently, was John Rubinstein. During a review session a year ago for our NRAM grant, you saw one of my tomograms, and you said, "Are the particles really shaped like that?" And so from then on, I started studying them and actually thinking about what's going on. And so what is an ideal grid? What does an ideal sample in holes look like? You have your electron beam here, and you want thin ice, so you only want maybe 10 to 20 nanometers of space on either side of your particles so that they're not actually interacting with the air-water interface, hopefully. You want non-overlapping particles in the beam direction. So you don't want one pick to be actually two particles. So imagine if you had another particle above this one. You want maximally concentrated particles in your holes and no particle-particle interactions. So maximally concentrated to increase your signal-to-noise so you can estimate your CTF properly. Of course, you want randomly oriented particles, and you want your particles perpendicular to the beam so that you can use, for instance, a whole image defocus estimation across your entire particle set. And of course, no air-water interface interactions. So you might be thinking to yourself, "Well, I make some perfect grids, so I don't have to worry about this talk." So what do you guys think? Go on. Okay. What percentage of grids that I've looked at do you think? I've looked at over 50 samples, have areas with ideal characteristics. So I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. Less than 10%? About a quarter? Half? All right. 75%? 90%? All right. You made nanodiscs, so you're cheating. Okay. So the answer is actually less than 10%. And actually, it's less than 5% of all the samples that I've looked at have areas that are ideal. Why? What are we doing wrong? Let's look at this list again and see what's happening. So thin ice, about two-thirds of the samples that I've looked at have areas with less than 50 nanometer ice thickness. About two-thirds have non-overlapping particle areas. About a half or greater are well saturated, between 60% to 90% in those air-water interface regions. About 40% of samples have randomly oriented particles, at least apparently. And about 80% of samples, since I'm doing tomography, I can actually determine the orientation of the sample, the grid of that area with respect to the electron beam, are less than 5 degrees off from perpendicular to the beam normal. So there's one thing I'm missing. Yes. So when you have an exposure area, of course you want your beam to be perpendicular. It's not necessarily perpendicular, it's tilted, either by inaccurate stage, either by local variations in your grid, bent grids, or variations in your whole topography. All right, so clearly here I'm missing the air-water interface. So again, I'm going to ask you, what percentage of all the particles, not all the samples that I've studied, all the particles are at the air-water interface. So make a guess here. A, 10%, 25%, half, one for half, three quarters, maybe about a third of the room, more than 90%, maybe half the room. All right? So democracy did work here, and it's actually over 90% of all particles that I've looked at are adsorbed to the air-water interface. Okay, so this is perhaps unfortunate if one of those samples is yours. So why should you care about the air-water interface? Well, I think I just made my point. You must care about the air-water interface. All right, so here are some examples of tomograms that I've collected. This is aligned without fiducials. These are collected straight from regular single particle preps, so we're not adding any fiducials or doing extra preparation. This was just after we installed a phase plate. We had Rod over, and we decided, okay, let's go ahead and collect a tomogram. 20 minutes later, we had this, and it was beautiful, and started analyzing, trying to figure out what in the world's going on. And as you can see from this recreation of a cross-section, most of the particles, I'd say about 85-90%, are stuck to this bottom curved air-water interface here. And there's a lot hugging this carbon. Another example here, hemagglutinin. This is a more recent example. Both air-water interfaces are about equally saturated. Here's that second layer right there. I should have mentioned we're going in the Z direction through the ice, so directly through the ice, up and down in the beam direction. And there's only a few free floating particles. Yes, go ahead.
Looking at the cross section you're showing there, one of the surfaces is curved, the other one is flat. That's impossible, theoretically. You have capillary pressure inside, so both surfaces should have the same curvature, unless that's carbon support on one side.
So is the video lying, or?
I don't know.
I see what you're saying, but I haven't actually thought about that. Sorry?
Looks like there's carbon on the side of the hole.
Oh, yes. This is probably near the edge of a hole. But that shouldn't influence your argument.
Yeah. Should have the same curvature.
Right. It could be, and Bob mentioned this in one of
his... It's obviously not free ice. there almost certainly are. Is a protein skin acting like a surfactant. But I want to draw attention to another puzzle that ultimately needs a rational physical understanding. I think the number of particles you have that you can count on the two surfaces must greatly exceed the number of particles that were in the volume of liquid that remains.
Yes.
So one possibility is, as you put the drop on the holy carbon, there's an air-water interface at the bottom, you get one layer. And the other top of the drop, you equally fast make another layer, and when you blot away, that top skin is not ripped away at all. It collapses down to...
This is a spotted on grid, I believe.
A spotted on will do the same thing. You have two air-water interfaces.
Right. Yeah,
and the middle gets thinned away eventually, and you're left with the two skins. That's a speculation. That's a hypothesis, and we should have other hypotheses on the table, and then think of experiments to narrow it down.
Of course.
Just a question: which side were the drops applied from in the spotted on grid?
Wonderful question, and we need to keep track of that better. So,
but the lip at the hole tells you.
Sorry.
There,
oh, the lip.
A little lip.
This one was collected, this whole grid was collected without
I didn't
any of
hear
the
you.
Carbon. There was no carbon in this collection, this particular collection.
This is a hole in carbon, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So the rim of the hole is asymmetric top to bottom.
Yes. And if we so collected could, that, we didn't collect it for this particular sample, but that's a good way to tell. Yeah.
I was wondering about the deformation of the ice during the exposure. Is that... Mm-hmm. I guess that must create some problems when you reconstruct the tomogram, but maybe the problems translate into this funny shape. I don't know. I'm not a tomographer.
I don't think there's sufficient deformation in ice. I mean, I can, in almost all of my tomograms, like, yes, stomy. Yeah, I understand. The alignment procedure I use might take care of all that. It takes care of a ton of parameters, different orientations of, you know, every single tilt image, and the entire tilt axis is modeled. So that might be included in the. Actually, I think it is. I should mention, I guess now, that the alignment procedure is essentially a signal maximization procedure in the reconstructed volume. So it takes the first few images, aligns them by correlation, the 0 degree and the next couple images, does a weighted back projection of those three images, and then reprojects in the direction of the next image, back projects, reprojects the lines, back projects the new image, reprojects the lines, et cetera, sequentially adding more signal to your back projected tomogram.
Are you undistorting the individual frames? I mean, my point is you're reconstructing something that can't really be reconstructed perfectly because the sample shape changes during the experiment. Anyway, that was my question.
I'm guessing it doesn't change enough because I can make out particles and they look proper.
How to continue the discussion in the panel?
Yeah, I just want to make one comment about spatium.
Go ahead, Anne.
Hi. So spatium is also asymmetrically blocked. If you think about it, the hair is grow on one side. So I think for this profile to be not symmetrical, I think it's could that could happen too.
Okay, I'll continue here. And here's another example. So this is rabbit autolase. And this is a spotted on gold nanowire grid, and you can see very thin ice, and then this lip right by the edge of the hole right here, just as I've drawn over here, so 15 nanometer ice. But it's still stuck on those edges, or adsorbed to those edges, so I believe it's still adsorbed in the central region also. All right, so as I said, over 1,000 tomograms I've collected, 50 preps, with incubation times on the order of about a second for the sample on the grid before it's frozen. About 90% of all particles are on their water interface. So here's what I've learned. So at the center of holes, I've gone through, done thickness measurements, taken note of where all the particles are, at what saturations they are, what angles these particle layers exist relative to the electron beam. So here at the center of holes, about 60% are in one layer, 20% are in two layers. The thickness of the ice, gold spotted on winds with 31 or so nanometers, plus or minus a good amount, but this is over a large number of samples. Carbon spotted on 47 nanometers, and holy carbons, which are either quantifoil or C-flats, about 60 nanometers. And the specimen tilt ranges from between about 3 degrees and 8 degrees. At the edge of holes, where I measure about 100 nanometers from the edges, there's about 20% with one layer and 60% with two layers, so it's flipped from the center of the holes. The ice thickness is about double for the spotted on grids and about 50% more for the holy carbon grids. And the tilt of these layers with respect to the electron beam increases to about 3 to 10 degrees. All right, so should you be worried about this? Now I'm gonna switch to some literature, some different literature, to try to answer this question. So we have not studied this. There is a bunch of fields that are interested in oil-water and air-water interfaces and also surface-water interfaces. These fields, strangely enough, are food colloid fields, where Scientists or researchers are interested in improving taste in your foamed beer, improving the texture in your various whipped creams, and improving digestive abilities in your yogurt, for instance. So what have they found, and how might it be applicable here? And I'm not sure if this is all applicable, so this is some speculative research here in, with regards to cryo-EM. So like Bob mentioned before, these groups use Langmuir Blodgett troughs. These are very clean setups. There's about 10 to 1,000 milliliters of sample that is poured into these troughs, and then the top of those troughs are cleaned by simply skimming over the entire trough. Then a few different methods are used to study the buildup of monolayers, be them lipids or proteins, at the air-water interfaces. So infrared reflective absorptive spectroscopy, where they do some low-angle scattering to try to understand various thicknesses of layers, along with peeling those layers off onto, for instance, mica, and studying those layers of LB films, is what they call them, Langmuir Blodgett films, with AFM. So these are very clean setups. Usually they prep their instruments by cleaning them with chloroform and or fire. And so we clearly don't do this, and Bob has pointed this out in a recent review. And so we might be introducing surfactants and various proteins from our environment, from our tweezers, from our hands, to all our samples, to all our grids. All right, so what have they found, and how does it compare with what we've estimated? So Bob and Chris have both estimated bulk diffusion times, is what I'm calling it, for going from bulk proteins down to absorbed interface at the interface proteins. They've estimated about 1 millisecond to 0.1 seconds for proteins to absorb to the interface. These food science studies, at least with this egg white protein, a 45 kilodalton protein that looks like this, took about 0.3 milliseconds. Now, after those initial proteins absorb to the air-water interface, they may denature. And that denature time I'm calling surface diffusion time. And these food science literatures, at least the same literature, estimated between, it was about 10 and 25 milliseconds for their particular proteins. All right, and how thick are these monolayers? And are they even just monolayers? So a couple different experiments have shown that they're between 1 and 10 nanometers thick, using about 0.1 meg per mil bulk protein. And this one piece of work in particular showed that by increasing the concentration of the bulk protein from 0.1 to 100 megs per mil, increased the denatured layer thickness from 5 to 50 nanometers. So it just kept denaturing. Now, they have also studied in these Langmuir troughs, where once they build up a protein network at the air-water interface, they've added surfactant to the subphase underneath this air-water interface and let that surfactant start to displace, as you see in this time series set of AFM images, the protein networks. And as you can see, it's not displaced homogeneously. It's displaced heterogeneously, and there's clearly connections between protein fragments at this air-water interface. And these proteins partially desorb after they are completely or almost completely displaced by these surfactants. Also here, with different types of proteins, we have beta-globulin and beta-casein. This is a rather disordered protein. This is a globular protein. This globular protein, as you can see, is displaced by surfactant in a more heterogeneous manner than this disordered protein. So what we might conclude from here is that we're actually forming a protein network. Each of these individual proteins are not completely denaturing. They are staying together with respect to their their entire strand, and they're able to actually desorb back into the bulk solution if displaced. A study here has shown that on the x-axis is a measure of particle stability. So this is the surface area divided by the particle mass. And with higher mass, sorry, I should explain the experiment, they formed LB films with each of these proteins. And then they applied stress in the lateral direction and in the perpendicular direction, and made a function where they estimated the strength of the protein based on those two experiments. And they showed that more stable proteins, lower on the X, are have stronger protein network layers at the air-water interface. My battery is running low. All right, and how am I doing on time? I have no idea.
Badly.
5 minutes, okay. They've also shown that beta sheets in particular may not denature at the air-water interface. In fact, they're potentially alternating hydrophobic, hydrophilic residues in these beta sheets may just reorient so that they can survive the air-water interface. And after they survive, they might start connecting to neighboring protein networks via those beta sheets, thereby strengthening the network. A surface protein study has shown that potentially by adding more bulk protein to solution, so this is a metal surface of some sort, the orientations can change. If these particles get too close, they might have more affinity for each other than for the substrate, and they might change their orientation. So this might happen at air-water interfaces. Okay, so do we actually see any of this evidence in cryo-ET of cryo-EM samples? And the answer is, well, probably. So these are clustered protocations. These are multiple 13 kilodalton beta sheet beta barrel domains in this stick-like sample right here. And on the bottom air-water interface, you can see these little 13 kilodalton domains. Those are little beta barrel domains. They're the same size as each of these little dots on each of these particles here. And on the top air-water interface, you can see partial particles along with more of these little beta barrel domains. And in the ice as a control, you see essentially nothing, just ice. With and Priyamvada always hates that I show this sample because it's her worst sample, but it's great for this talk, so I'm sorry, Priyamvada. You can see this HIV trimer with some receptors shows some clear denatured receptors and or protein fragments at both air-water interfaces and none in the ice. And as you can see from this set of other samples, hemagglutinin in this case at very thin ice, the hemagglutinin itself couldn't fit in that layer, apparently. But there's a bunch of little protein fragments in here. Apoferritin, you can see little protein fragments floating around. GDH potentially also has some various protein fragments. T20S proteasome is an interesting example. You don't actually see any, at least by cryo-ET, any protein fragments. But not so fast. You can see some broken up proteasomes, or they're not whole proteasomes, these three proteasomes right here. And so perhaps these are denaturing even further than to the domain level. I'm going to skip by this example for time here. All right, so how do we avoid air-water interfaces potentially? As Bob and Chris and others have pointed out, you can use affinity grids with carbon or streptavidin or nickel NTA over holes. You can introduce surfactant to your protein solution. But there's some other ideas that exist. I'm going to go over those quite quickly here. Shores has a recent paper, or wait, is that 2008 or 2000? I think it's 2016, where there's some. He made some synthetic protein encapsulation devices, I suppose, where you can actually stick your protein in the middle, and essentially escape the air-wide interface and gain random preferred orientation. But this will clearly introduce a lot of signal-to-noise, a lot of noise in your signal-to-noise. There's also vault proteins that have been proposed that you can actually potentially throw your particle inside these natural proteins and just use them as these encapsulating particles. You can, alternatively, use these LB troughs. And this paper is actually a very interesting paper. It's a VitroBot that was coupled with a glove box to make a very clean environment inside the VitroBot where they built a Langmuir trough. And on top of that Langmuir trough, they put some lipid monolayer. They put their grid underneath in the subphase, and then they drained out the liquid, and they had some DNA here too that connected to preferentially to this lipid monolayer, and they did cryo-ET on it, which is what you're looking at right here, up to 70 plus or minus 70 degrees. They're able to actually see this lipid monolayer. So you can adsorb an entire lipid monolayer directly to your grid if you'd like, and that will avoid any of the surfactant protein competition if you put your surfactant directly into your solution. Also, you could just plunge faster. So I'm going to show right now, as Bridget alluded to and showed some evidence before, some examples, or one example actually, of apoferritin. This is 800 milliseconds from spot to plunge. And you can see in each of these tomograms, remember we're going through the Z direction, and you'll see two layers. We're next to the holes in each of these tomograms. And you'll have one layer here, and then maybe a couple floating particles here. Maybe 5% of the particles are floating in between, and you'll have a second layer. And the same for these two. When you drop down spotted on spot to plunge time to 170 milliseconds, you get about a third of your particles floating in between the two air-water interfaces, which is very encouraging. And this is expected to be different on a per-particle basis based on potentially the cross-discipline literature that I showed previously. So, but be careful. This is a low-end value. We haven't completely confirmed this yet, but it looks promising. All right, to summarize, but I'm a little over time here. So the ideal view is rarely correct. So every grid you're making is probably bad, unless you're using spotted on or something. I'm actually quite worried about this, because are we solving various conformations of your particle at the air-water interface? I'm not sure. So the vast majority of your particles are at the air-water interface, and it might take 10 or more milliseconds for your particles to both bulk diffuse and surface diffuse across the air-water interface, potentially forming protein networks. And this all depends on the particle's surface hydrophobicity, i.e. affinity to the air-water interface, the particle stability, as I showed with that one study, disulfide bonds, which strengthen your particle stability, the concentration of your particles, which determines the concentration of your protein network, the secondary structure, as I showed, beta sheets may survive the air-water interface, of course, your buffer, your temperature, et cetera. And the potential answers, I think the best answer is to plunge faster. All right, and so I'd like to quickly thank Bridget and Venkat and Hui. These two made over half of the grids that I've studied. Bridget and Bob have pushed me to continue down this road, and a lot of samples from these sources and unnameable sources. So, thank you.
Questions?
Alex, how did you say you cut down the time by a factor of 4 to plunge at the end?
How did I cut down the time?
So you showed 800 milliseconds and 170 milliseconds?
Yes.
How did you achieve that?
Some engineering magic by the Spotted On team. I don't
know. Oh, faster.
We plunge faster and a few other tricks, yeah.
Right here, Alex. Right here.
Hey.
So do you think if you knew, if you know the model of whatever, so if you have a structure of whatever it is you're imaging, is it possible to predict how it will interact with the air-water interface? I mean, I know you mentioned that there's a number of reasons, or there's a, you know.
I don't know of any way. I'd say just do it by experiment. I wouldn't even dream of predicting, but it's clearly determined by the surface hydrophobicity.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of reasons why it might stick.
Of course, yeah. So it only takes 15 minutes to collect a tilt series and 20 minutes to align it, so that's my answer to that question, yeah.
Here's a question. So it only takes like 10 milliseconds
potentially
for the particles to diffuse to the air-water interface. So why there's a difference, you plunge faster, you know, that will change the percentage of the particle to the surface? Or
so I think it's determined by the, let's call it, stickiness of the particle to the air-water interface. So we know it's bouncing a lot. It has a lot of time to hit the air-water interface before you plunge in that 170 milliseconds. So if it doesn't have enough affinity to the air-water interface to actually stick in a stochastically high manner, then